Danger is stealing in as relapse sums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Hello and welcome to episode 128.1 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. As you can tell from the rather half-assed introduction music, this is not really a proper episode of the Thinking Poker Podcast. I hesitate even to call it episode 128.5 because only probably about 10% of the effort that goes into a usual podcast effort episode is going into this episode. There's no editing, there's no bumper music, there's no guests, there's not even another host. It's just me, Andrew Brokus, coming at you from San Francisco, California. We almost were not going to have an episode at all this week, but given that we missed last week's episode, I didn't want to go 2 weeks in a row without having one. I've just been very busy in Las Vegas. Well, for the last episode, many of you probably heard episode 128, was right after Nate had arrived in Las Vegas. I had been in there for a few days already. We recorded, and then, you know, there was about a week in there. We were both playing a lot of poker and didn't record another episode. And then he returned to Massachusetts. I was still in Las Vegas playing poker pretty much every day. And, you know, our usual recording time is after work for Nate, which is about 5 p.m. Las Vegas time, and even a little later than that, just anywhere in that neighborhood is just, you know, right smack in the middle of the kind of prime time for me to be playing poker. So there just hasn't been a good time for us to sit down and record. And, you know, it seems kind of unfortunate because it only happens once or maybe twice a year that the two of us are in the same place, and to some extent, it feels like we should take advantage of that opportunity to record, but, you know, for Nate, it's one of the only opportunities he gets to play poker at all. For me, it's some of the best opportunities I have to play poker all year, so, yeah, recording just falls a little bit by the wayside. We do plan on having a regular episode next week. We've got a guest lined up about whom we are excited, but for now, you've just got me. I'm going to look to talk to you a little bit about the World Series of Poker. Got a couple of announcements to make, a couple of people I want to congratulate. I'll talk a little bit about my own experience the first 2 weeks or so of the WSOP that I was out there for, and we'll have some strategy talk as well. I think I'm going to, I want to talk about donk betting generally, and I have a few examples, some of which come from WSOP events, one of which comes from a cash game hand that I played, but they're all going to deal with the concept of donk betting. First thing that I want to announce, I guess it's really the only announcement, is that we are going to have a KnitCast meetup in Las Vegas again this year. It's going to take place on day 1B of the main event, but we're going to start it at 10 a.m. So even if you are playing day 1B of the main event, I would still, you know, we hope you'll still stop by a little bit in the morning and say hello. Could be a nice way even to get you fired up for the main event to come and meet Nate and myself. Hopefully we'll have some of our former guests on the show, some other listeners. Should be a good way to get you fired up if you are going to play the main event that day. So that's going to be July 6th. Just like last year, it will be at the Bowling Alley in the Gold Coast Casino, which is kind of the KnitCast headquarters out in Las Vegas. Although, you know, Carlos has pointed out that it seems like more and more people are kind of catching on to the Gold Coast and what a good alternative it is to the Rio, especially now that the Rio is starting to charge a higher and higher resort fee. There is a resort fee at the Gold Coast, but it's lower and the rack rates are lower, and it really is, it's such a short walk from the Rio. It's literally right across the street. So even if you're staying at the Rio or just playing at the Rio, quite convenient to come over to the Gold Coast. Hard to miss the Bowling Alley. It's pretty much the entire upstairs of the of the casino, so just find an escalator, go up, and the Bowling Alley will be up there. I don't think it'll be too hard to find us. Don't imagine the Bowling Alley is going to be super crowded at 10 a.m. We'll be there at least between 10 a.m. and noon. Generally, these things end up going later than planned. You know, maybe we'll end up getting lunch at the Subway downstairs. So if you come by afternoon and you don't see us up in the Bowling Alley, check the Subway downstairs in the Golden Coast. We might be hanging out there getting some lunch as well. But we'll be over at the Gold Coast the morning of July 6th. Nate will be there. I'll be there. I imagine Carlos will be there. And I'm sure we'll get some of our former guests, some new listeners, some old listeners, some people who have been at past podcast meetups before. I don't want to promise on anyone's behalf because we don't have any other confirmed guests, but it should be a good time. We've always had a good time at these meetups. I hope that you'll be able to join us. Once again, that's July 6th. 10 a.m. to noon, possibly later than that, at the bowling alley at Gold Coast. And there are some drinks there for sale. So if you want to get coffee or a soda or whatever, they do have like a snack bar there where you can get that sort of stuff. World Series of Poker wise, so I'm just back from Las Vegas. Literally, I've been in San Francisco for less than 24 hours. It'll probably be about 24 hours when I broadcast this or when I publish this. I was out there for the first little over 2 weeks of the series. I played, how many events did I play? Like six or seven events during that time, which I think is a good mix. You know, many of you probably know I came straight from Vancouver, so I'd been in Vancouver for a little over 2 weeks playing the Spring Championship of Online Poker, which was involved playing poker pretty much every day. I took one day off when I was in Vancouver, and then when I flew to Las Vegas, I didn't play poker that way that day. So when I first got to Las Vegas, I wasn't necessarily in the mood to start playing poker immediately. I think I talked a little bit about this on the previous episode. So I took a few days off to catch up on coaching, do some errands, that sort of thing. We recorded that episode with Nate and Carlos. And then, you know, I did play poker pretty much every day after that, starting from that day when we recorded episode 128 and the three of us got together. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. And I was probably about half and half tournaments in cash. And there were, you know, some days where I even played both, depending on how quickly I went out of a tournament. I did have an objective that I wanted to focus a little bit more on cash this year. You know, tournaments, I mean, there are some really great value tournaments at the World Series of Poker, but I really do want to be focused on value when I play tournaments. We talked a bit about this last episode as well, the relationship between happiness and playing. And I think we've probably quoted Tommy Angelo before on the show with this, but he says, and I think this is true, like the pleasure to pain principle is really out of whack in a tournament. The extent to which it hurts to bust out of a $1,500 WSOP event in which I don't even have 100% of myself, like, it hurts me more than losing $1,500 in a cash game hurts me. And I think that's pretty true. I think it's true for a lot of people, which kind of raises the question then of what really is the point of playing the tournaments. Obviously, they're much higher variance, which for some people, and I think particularly for recreational players, the fact that tournaments are higher variance is part of what's fun about them. It's similar to a lottery ticket where you can, for a small amount of money, you can potentially get a big score. I don't think that's something that a professional should really be, like, I don't think professionals should be thinking in those terms. Your objective is, you're not a professional gambler, you're a professional poker player, and variance really is your enemy to some extent. I mean, for the most part, bankroll management, right, that, I mean, that literally is what bankroll management is about trying to minimize your variance, right? If you're a winning player, the only thing that can stop you from making money is variance. So, you know, playing a format of poker that has the highest variance that there is a little bit counterintuitive to that. Now, the reasons, you know, for playing tournaments, one is that they tend to have softer fields, and that is particularly true in the World Series of Poker. The fact that it is the World Series of Poker, that it's the kind of thing that a lot of people are going to, it might be a bucket list item for some people, which, by the way, Carlos played his first, he played his first World Series of Poker tournament, and he made his first day two in a World Series of Poker tournament. I don't believe he cashed either of the WSOP events he played, but congratulations, Carlos, on that. Hopefully that brought you some happiness, although I do think Carlos is a little over it with live poker at this point, which I can understand. But I do think that, you know, it's a bucket item for a lot of people. There's a lot of people who wouldn't usually play poker for these stakes who will, you know, like they wouldn't, maybe they're usually like one, two players who are buying in for $100 or $200, but they'll play a $1,500 WSOP event. So, I mean, this is an opportunity to play poker for higher stakes with people who don't usually play higher stakes, which is nice. You know, tournaments have their own skill set, and I know that there are some people who specialize in that. You know, I'm not really one of those people. I think to some extent my edge, well, if I could play against the same people, if I could just take
take the player pool from a $1,500 World Series of Poker event and deposit those people at like a 5-10 cash game table with $1,500 in front of them. I would much rather play them in the ladder format, but you know, unfortunately, that's not the way it works. So, you know, if you want to play with people who are not as skilled, you know, the World Series of Poker gives you a good opportunity to do that. I do think there are some people for whom the tournaments are either particularly well suited just because of their character or because of the poker skills that they've cultivated. I think I have, I'm pretty confident that I have the skills to compete in cash game poker as well. And to some extent, I even think there are people who, you know, arrogantly or not, I might say, are not as good an all-around poker player as I am, or don't have the level of understanding of poker that I do, but who probably do have a better understanding of 30 big blind poker than I do, or 20 big blind poker than I do. So to some extent, I feel like, you know, I'm even giving up something to some people when I'm playing, if I'm playing short stacked with a tournament professional. You know, I don't think I'm making huge mistakes, but I don't know that I have an edge on that player either, playing in a 30 big blind sort of format. So that's kind of the downside, or that can be an upside or a downside, I suppose. But for me, I think it's potentially a downside, or at least I have the skills to compete in cash games as well. So it's not like I have to say, well, I don't know how to play cash, so I can really only be a tournament professional. I think some people are in that boat, but I really am not. There is something fun about playing the WSOP events. I mean, there really is nothing as exciting as getting deep in a poker tournament. Being poker-wise, like, even having a big win in a cash session is really not the equivalent of getting deep in a big tournament, and especially getting deep in a WSOP event. You know, I've been fortunate enough to do that several times in the main event. I've been in the top 100 three times in the WSOP main event, so that, needless to say, is a pretty tremendous thrill. I do wonder sometimes to what extent am I kind of chasing that high, and is it really a rational thing? I mean, the expectation-wise, I don't know if I would, like, bet on doing that well in the WSOP main event, even if I, you know, play it every year for the next 20 years. I don't know if I'm a favorite to make the top 100 over during that time. So it might be a little bit, you know, irrational that, you know, Carlos and I have talked a bit about this. You know, I mentioned him being, to some extent, over it with live tournaments. And I think part of that is that he has not, you know, he's experienced that level of success in online tournaments. He's never experienced it in live tournaments, never experienced it at the World Series of Poker. And I mean, that may be in some way a blessing. Obviously, I'm pretty happy with the money that I've won as a result of some of the deep runs I've made in the main event. And I was the final two tables in a PLO8 event 2 years ago in 2013. So that's actually the closest I've come to a WSOP final table. So, you know, I definitely am can consider the money that I won in those circumstances a blessing. But in terms of, you know, it may have biased my decision-making to the point where I'm now kind of chasing those sorts of experiences. And when you play a tournament like, well, I did not play the Colossus, and Nate and I talked a bit on a previous episode about why we chose not to play the Colossus. But even when you play a tournament with several thousand entrants, it's so unlikely that you're going to make any kind of deep run. It's far more likely that you're going to end up getting somewhat deep and then busting, you know, either with a min cash or with no cash at all. And that really, I mean, it can be both pretty painful, and it consumes a lot of time for which you don't receive any money. Although, you know, selling action is certainly helpful with that and helps to offset that variance problem. But I think a fair amount of the time, my hourly rate is at least close if I'm able to find a good cash game. And I'll come back to the question of, you know, finding a good cash game. But if I can find a good 5-10 or certainly a good 10-25 game to sit in, that's quite possibly a higher hourly rate for me than, certainly, than playing the early levels of a $1,500 tournament. I generally avoided the larger buy-in WSOP events. I think the fields, like, the main reason I'm playing these tournaments is because of the softer fields. Like, if I'm going to play against tough opponents, I'd rather do it in a cash game than in a tournament. And I sort of already explained why that's true, but I just think that the edge that I have on good but non-elite players. I mean, I really know what that edge, that what that edge is in a cash game. In a tournament, I don't know that I have that edge. If I'm playing with other professionals in a tournament setting, there are tournament specialists who I think potentially even have an edge on me. So yeah, I don't want to enter like a $5,000 eight-handed tournament, or certainly like a $10,000 non-hold'em game. Like there's no non-hold'em game that I'm nearly good enough at to compete in a $10,000 event. So when I'm playing tournaments, it's really because I want to be competing with people who are, you know, much less good poker players than I'm going to find in a 5, 10, or 10, 25 game. And if I'm mostly going to play with other professionals, which I think is the case if I enter something like $5,000 eight-handed event, I might as well go and do that. Which is, it's the same thing if I sit down on a 5, 10 table. Most of the other people I'm playing with are pretty decent opponents. Certainly a 10, 25, that's true. And if I'm going to play with tough players one way or the other, I'd rather do it in a cash game. I think that's a place where I'm going to have more of an edge on those sorts of players. So I avoided the higher buy-in events, and I really tried to focus on the WSOP events that were the highest value, and also ones where... So, I mean, your hourly rate in a tournament is constantly changing because the stakes are always getting higher in a tournament. So, you know, I don't know exactly how to quantify that level by level, but, you know, I think my hourly rate during level one or level two of the $1,500 WSOP event is not that high. The thing is that you only spend 1 hour playing hour one of the Millionaire Maker, for instance, and then the stakes go up, and now you're playing hour two, and your hourly rate is higher, and then hour three, your hourly rate is higher. So what tends to happen in these WSOP events is they represent a good opportunity. And what I'll, either I'll, if I bust in the first few hours, that's no problem. I'll go play cash, and I haven't wasted a lot of time on the tournament. If I don't bust in the first few hours, then at least theoretically, my hourly rate is pretty good while playing that tournament, like better than it would be if I were sitting in a 5-10 or a 10-25 game. That's kind of how I approached this, and I chose tournaments that I thought would have particularly soft fields. The only tournament that I really played, well, I did expect a soft field in the $1,500 Raz event, but I was also kind of playing that for fun. There just aren't that many, which maybe sounds perverse to say that you're playing Raz for fun, but there just aren't that many opportunities to play a big Raz tournament, a live Raz tournament with. And I did have someone at my table, my starting table of eight. The one of those people had never played Raz before, didn't really know the rules. He wasn't a terrible poker player. I mean, it's not like he was calling with a pair of kings or something, but I mean, he just, not that I'm a great Raz player, but he just clearly had no chance of even cashing, and he did bust quite quickly. So that's a pretty good ratio. I mean, if I don't know if I was running good there, but if every table consists of seven people who are at least reasonably competent and one person who is complete dead money, that's pretty good. I mean, that's an overlay of close to $200 on a $1,500 buy-in event if 1/8 of the field is complete dead money. So, I mean, that right there is more than covering the rake in that event. I mean, that's only one table, so LOL sample size. But that was kind of my thinking on entering the Raz event, and I did find it interesting. I also found it kind of overwhelming. I mean, I did some studying of Raz before I entered the tournament, and I had this idea that I was going to really try to take careful notes on hands that I played. I thought maybe I'll get some good blog or podcast content out of this. I know you guys enjoy it. I definitely enjoy getting to talk to Nate in particular about non-hold'em games and strategy and non-hold'em games. So I thought, well, I'll get this good strategy, and I'm going to need, it'll be a learning experience for me too, and I'll pay real careful attention to how people are playing and what they're betting and checking, and I'll really work on my hand reading, and I'll pay attention to hands that go to showdown. And I don't know if you guys have ever played live stud games before. This is only the second time that I did. A few years ago, I played a live stud eight event. It's really, it can be kind of overwhelming. There's a lot of information out there, and just trying to keep track of cards that have been folded, right? So that's very relevant in Raz, knowing if you're starting in Raz with a hand like ace 2-5, then knowing whether threes and fours are live is very, and to some extent sixes and sevens is very relevant for you. The ace 2-5 is a stronger starting hand if no one else is showing a three or a four than if multiple threes and fours are showing. Even if they fold on third street, so they never go to fourth, they don't contest the pot with you, it's still relevant to know that those threes and fours aren't out there, because that reduces the chance that you're going to improve your hand. Those are the best cards. Like, those are the cards that I'm hoping to catch on the next street. So knowing that there's few of those in the deck reduces the value of my hand. So you really need to pay attention to especially small cards that have been folded. For you, unlike stud eight, you don't have to track every single card that's folded. You know, certain cards, it's pretty irrelevant whether somebody folds a king or a queen. It can make a very small difference, but it's not really something I bother to track. I do try to keep track of any card 9 or lower that's folded, what's been dealt, so I have an idea of how live my hand is, how live my opponent's hands are. In this way, if you see that an opponent catches something like a 3 on 4th or 5th street, you have some idea of how likely it is that that card paired your opponent. If 3s are very live, then you know that there's a decent chance it paired your opponent, like that a 3 is one of his down cards. Whereas if you can account for 2 or 3 of the other 3s in the deck, and then your opponent catches a 3, it's unlikely that that 3 paired your opponent. So that's the kind of thing that, just paying attention to that really taxed my abilities. So and the action tends to happen pretty quickly, at least when you're dealing with people who are more experienced Draz players than I am. I mean, these people who... I just think generally the action is going more quickly than it is in a no-limit event. So that made it a little harder for me to track action. And then finally, when hands are exposed at showdown, you can't always tell what, you know, like online, you can look at a hand history and you can see what were the cards that a person started with, what were their 2 down cards, what card did they catch on the river. You know, in a live game, people just turn over their hands, and sometimes you can't even remember what cards had been their up cards in order to deduce what must have been their down cards. You can't always tell which 2 down cards they started with versus which one they caught on the river, because those get sort of shuffled together. So I didn't really have the opportunity to capture the kind of information that I wanted to capture. I did find it interesting. I did find it to be a learning experience. I also found it a little bit overwhelming, and I did not cash in that event. So I played the Raz. I played the 6 Max. I'm going to come back and talk about a hand from, or maybe multiple hands from the 6 Max. But I played the 6 Max. I did end up cashing the 6 Max. Turned into something like a min cash, but that was a pretty good experience. That was the only WSOP event that I've cashed so far, and I will be coming back for the main event. So I played those 2, and then I had planned on playing the shootout, but because I made day 2 of the 6 Max, I was not able to play the shootout. So then the next tournaments that I played were the Millionaire Maker. Day 1A, I didn't have the greatest table draws, probably. My starting table was pretty good, but that table broke pretty quickly. I played at a couple of other tables, and I played with quite a few really tough opponents, and there was one hand, I blogged about this, I'm not going to go into great detail here, but there was one hand where I got triple barreled in this spot where I would have been very comfortable folding to pretty much everyone. I did end up folding, but the player who did this, I kind of feel like it might have been a mistake for me to fold as strong of a hand as I did to a triple barrel, and it's just sort of unfortunate in a tournament with as soft of a field as this for me to run into somebody who's capable of putting me in a spot like that where I feel like I had a close decision, and against most people it would have been an easy fold. So I feel like I was not super fortunate with my table draws on day 1A. I did bust day 1A. I re-entered on day 1B, and my table draws on 1B were amazing. I only played for a couple of hours, unfortunately, but it really made me glad that I entered the tournament. I was like, yeah, this is a great... this is definitely a good decision. So I played it. I got opportunities to put my money in good a few times. Unfortunately, I did not take money back out of the pots on several of those occasions. I ended up busting. I went and played cash, got into a decent 10-25 game at the Rio. So that I really just consider an all-around success. And I think that needs to be your attitude when you enter a tournament. Like, you can't be too invested in doing well in the tournament. I mean, you certainly need to be trying your hardest. Like, I'm not saying I went in with I'm just going to, you know, try to double up or lose sort of thing. But I think you really have to be completely okay with busting. I think one of the big mistakes people mistake when... One of the biggest mistakes people make when they're playing tournaments is they're just overly invested in their survival in the tournament. And certainly survival is important, but if you're so concerned about not getting eliminated that you're not capable of, you know, taking advantage of the kind of good spots that I got into where, you know, I put a lot of money in good and just didn't get there, it's really hard to do well in the tournament. So I went into this not expecting that I was going to cash or not expecting that I was going to do particularly well and being okay with that, and more just thinking, well, you know, I'm going to do my best and hopefully I'll either go deep or go out early. The worst case scenario in my mind would be making day 2 and not cashing, where I pretty much just waste an entire day when I could have been playing cash. So I went off, played cash, made back my buy-in and then some. That was a success as far as I was concerned for that day. I played on Sunday. I played the 1K Turbo. That one really fit nicely with my plan. It's a 1K. It's the same weekend as the Millionaire Maker, so there's lots of people who are there for the Millionaire Maker who've already busted out of the Millionaire Maker. Lots of recreational players jumping into the Turbo, and obviously it's a Turbo, so if you're going to bust, you usually bust pretty quickly, which I did. Once again, went and played cash that day. Played just a generic 1500-hour WSOP event. That was, I didn't bust quite so quickly, although I did bust towards the end of day one that day. But that one also felt like a pretty good value. It was a weekday 1500, so not quite as soft as like the Millionaire Maker. It wasn't any kind of special gimmick tournament. It was just a nine-handed 1500-hour tournament. But it definitely felt like a good value. I had fun in that one. And then the last thing that I played, I took a few days off after that, and the final thing that I played was Monster Stack. I played the Monster Stack, and that is, it's actually a little inconsistent with my philosophy of like wanting to bust early if I'm going to bust, because you start with a lot of chips, but I actually did manage to bust in about 3 hours, even despite starting with a lot of chips, and that really was just a result of a big coin flip that I took, where I got it in nines versus ace king offsuit for start with 15,000 chips. I put in about 10,000 on this hand. There was a decent amount of overlay because two other people had folded pre-flop after putting a decent amount of money in the pot, and I lost, which is fine. Some people say, well, you don't want to risk your tournament life on a coin flip, and oh, that would be true if you weren't getting odds on the coin flip, but when you're getting pretty substantial overlay, it's definitely a good spot to get an N9s versus Ace-King, and this is the kind of thing that I have in mind when I say you can't be so concerned about your survival that you're unwilling to put your money in the pot with 9s when it's right to do so. The other thing I was going to make, I talked about not playing the Colossus, and Nate and I talked about why we chose not to play the Colossus. We did record that episode of the last episode of the podcast, 128, was on, I think it was day 1A of the Colossus. So we had this idea in our head that, okay, we'll get together in the morning, we'll record the podcast. After we recorded, we went and got lunch, and then we went over to the Aria, and we thought, okay, well, we'll call ahead, we'll put our names on the waiting list, we'll go over to the Aria, and we'll play poker for a few hours. And Carlos can play the daily tournament, Nate and I can play cash, whatever stakes we want to play. It turns out on the weekend of the Colossus, you are not just going to roll up to a Las Vegas casino with at least not one of the ones that has a big famous poker room like the Aria and expect to get a seat. We were on the waiting list for, it was probably 2 hours, and I was still not even in the top, however many people they display on the screen that shows the waiting list. I think 20 or 24 or something. I still wasn't even in the top 20 or 24 for a 5-10 game. Every table was full. Nate and Carlos were still on the alternate list for the tournament that they tried to enter. So we ended up just giving up on that and driving to the Red Rock, which, it's always fun to go to the Red Rock. I felt a little bit like a waste. I mean, I'm only going to get so many Fridays in Las Vegas during the World Series of Poker, and it felt a little bit like a waste that I couldn't really get into a game that I consider worth my time, but we did have fun out there. I would have rather had fun on a less potentially profitable night, but that was really just my own lack of planning and lack of foresight in terms of how the thousands, if not tens of thousands of people in town to play the Colossus were going to affect the poker scene. And I did learn my lesson from that. So the next day, I went straight to the Bellagio, which I actually had not played at the Bellagio in many years. And I always kind of, I think I might have talked about this on the show before too, I've always felt, well, I used to feel, a little like an outsider at the Bellagio. It seemed like there were so many regulars there, and rightly or wrongly, I had the sense that some of them were getting kind of preferential treatment, and it's just not as, I really enjoy playing at the Aria. If I could find games as good as what are going at the Bellagio at the Aria, that would be my preferred place to play. It's just a great poker room. The food you can get at the table is better than what you can get just about anywhere else, I think. It's very comfortable, it's very posh. I mean, the Bellagio is posh, but I think it's in a more sort of like stuffy way, and I don't know, but anyway, I for whatever reason I had a bit of a the Bellagio just had kind of a negative vibe for me. I never had a lot of interest to play there, but it seemed like the place to go. So I went to the Bellagio. I got there about 10 a.m. I got right away, even already at 10 a.m., there were like good 10:25 games going. I got into one. I played for like 9 hours or something, and the game was reasonably good throughout the day. I think there were always at least two or three spots, which for a 10:25 game is quite good. There were some pretty tough players in that game as well, but it was a profitable session for me. It was a good level of challenge, I think. I didn't feel like overwhelmed or anything. I did feel like I was in good spots constantly, and to have a good 10:25 game, you know, starting at 10 a.m. and running for 9 hours, like, maybe that sounds early to you all, but I'm a morning person, so being able to get a game started that early was just great for me. And it definitely would not have worked out if I had tried to show up at 1 p.m. I saw what the lines look like at Bellagio that day, and I was glad that I had gotten there at 10. So that ended up working out pretty nicely, and then that Sunday was busy as well. So if they run the Colossus again next year, make sure that you plan accordingly. If you aren't playing the Colossus and you think you're going to play poker somewhere else in Las Vegas, make sure you get there early, because the huge number of people who were in Las Vegas looking to play poker that weekend really affected the scene there. As I mentioned, I do want to talk some strategy, and I've already rambled about this other stuff more than I intended to. I want to talk about donk betting specifically, and of course I do want to give props to our sponsor, Tournament Poker Edge. Tournament Poker Edge, if you enjoy hearing me talk strategy briefly on the show, Tournament Poker Edge is the place to hear me talk really in-depth poker strategy. I've made, I don't even know how many video series for them, but I mean, I'm probably getting close to 100 videos that I've made now for Tournament Poker Edge, which is, I don't know, between 50 and 100 hours of content, and it really runs the gamut. So I've got some theoretical stuff on there where I talk about what I consider some of the most important kind of big picture concepts in poker, stuff like hand reading, value betting, bluffing. I just recently did a big theory series dealing with the concept of range construction and you know, kind of applying game theory to some common situations. I've done entire tournament hand history reviews from live and online tournaments. You can see me kind of walking hand through hand, at least the most important hands from tournaments that I've gone deep in, or just tournaments that I thought were interesting. You can see me review tournaments other people have played. I think I even have a video on there. This is kind of recorded live while I'm playing. So just a lot of different sort of strategy content. And that's just the stuff that I provided. There's plenty of other talented video producers making videos for Tournament Poker Edge as well. Definitely would encourage you to sign up for them. You can do that by going to tournamentpokeredge.com. So donk betting. This is a question that a lot of people ask about, and I mean, even that name, it's kind of an old convention, because people used to talk about it as something that like only weak players did, but it actually is something that throws quite a lot of people off, which, I mean, that by itself is a reason why maybe you should think about doing it yourself. So donk betting here tends to mean betting into the player who was the preflop riser, right? Traditionally is a good word. Traditionally, people tend to check on the flop to whichever player was the preflop aggressor. And then, you know, sometimes they fold, sometimes they call, sometimes they raise, but usually they let the preflop aggressor drive the action. So donk betting means when you don't check to the preflop raiser. So if you call a raise out of the blinds, or if you raise and then call a 3-bet from a player who has position on you, and then rather than checking to that player, you choose to bet the flop, that's what I mean by a donk bet. Now, this is different than if you have position on the preflop raiser. So maybe the preflop raiser raises preflop, and you call on the button, and then she checks the flop, and you bet. That's not going to be a donk bet, because you've already seen that you've given the preflop raiser a chance to act, and she didn't, and now you're the one betting. So that's different. We're talking about instances where you're kind of taking the betting initiative away from the preflop raiser. Now, just on a theoretical level, you might think about why would you want to do that, and I sort of caught myself before when I said the word traditionally, because it's not like we just check to the preflop raiser out of tradition. There are good reasons why it often makes sense to check to the preflop raiser. Usually the player who was the last aggressor on the previous street, that player tends to have at least a somewhat stronger range than someone who just called preflop. So when you raise preflop, I mean, most people are raising whenever they have really strong hands like aces and kings and queens and ace king and whatnot. So if you raise, you know, you could have a hand like that, whereas the player who calls you, because that player didn't re-raise, that player is not particularly likely to have those hands. Like, there are good reasons why it's usually correct to re-raise with hands as strong as aces and kings. So when you just call, even though you are kind of giving away the information that you at least probably don't have those hands, it's usually still better for you to. It's not generally worth whatever you give up by slow playing aces or kings just to confuse people about your calling range. So there are good reasons why the preflop raiser tends to have a stronger range than other people, and why it therefore makes sense to check to the preflop raiser. And this is also why continuation betting tends to be a thing, like why the person who raised preflop gets to be the one to bet the flop. It's not just a matter of, well, whoever bluffs first is going to win the pot. I mean, there are structural reasons why the player who raised preflop or the player who was the aggressor on the previous street usually has a stronger range going into the next street. So usually, you know, that person is going to bet when they have a strong hand on the flop. They're going to bet at least sometimes when they don't have a strong hand, just, you know, to represent that they have a strong one. And if you know that another player is usually going to bet and you flopped a strong hand, it probably makes sense for you to check and give that player a chance to bet before you raise with the strong hand that you flopped. So there are good reasons why when you flop a strong hand, you don't necessarily want to bet into the preflop raiser, because you want to give them a chance to if they're probably going to bet, you want to give them a chance to do that, and then you can raise with your strong hand. And therefore, if you're not donking your strong hands, then it becomes difficult to balance your donk bet. If you're only betting with bluffs or with weak hands, well, I imagine it's pretty obvious how you can take advantage of that, right? People can float you, they can bluff raise you. So if you're going to donk bet in an intelligent way, you've got to be doing it with some of your strong hands as well. And often it's not very desirable to do it with your strong hands, and that's why you don't tend to see a lot of donk betting. So we get a lot of questions on the show. I get a lot of questions from students and on Tournament Poker Edge and whatnot about, you know, should I be doing more donk betting? How do I deal with it when people donk bet into me? And there's no real easy answer to this. I do think that in general, the situations when it makes the most sense, you know, for you to employ a donk betting strategy or to have a donking range are in situations where you don't think a continuation bet is especially likely. So, you know, generally the reason you check to the preflop raiser is because a continuation bet is likely. So in a case where a c-bet does not seem likely, either because of the board texture, because of something you know about the player, like you just know this player doesn't c-bet that much, or sometimes if it's just a multi-way pot, I mean, if someone raises and gets called by four people, you can't really expect that person is going to bet the flop the majority of the time. But then again, if there are four people who all have an option to bet the flop, it still might make sense for you to check your stronger hands. But so the first thing for me is I don't do a lot of donk betting in situations where I think the preflop raiser is probably going to bet anyway. But there are certain boards that are not as good for the preflop raiser as others. So a board like ace, deuce, deuce, that tends to be very, very good for the preflop raiser. People raise preflop with a lot of strong aces, and people who don't 3-bet preflop usually don't have a lot of strong aces in their range. If the preflop raiser doesn't have a strong ace, he often has a big pocket pair, which is also, I mean, it may not seem like a strong hand on that board, but it's definitely not a hand that, it's not a hand that needs to bluff on that board. Like, if you have pocket queens, you're not going to make very many better hands fold if you bet an ace high flop, so it's still like a relatively strong hand on that board. It's not an air ball. So the preflop raiser tends to have a pretty strong hand on a board like that, or a pretty strong range on a board like that. It's not going to hold a lot of air. On the other hand, a flop like 6-7-8 is a board where the preflop raiser, depending on, especially if you raise this from early position, may not hit that board as well. Even if he plays 10-9 suited, that's only a couple combinations. Maybe he's playing some that he could flop a set, he could flop two pair, but a lot of time he's going to have unpaired overcards on a board like that. Just ace-king, ace-queen, ace-jack, king-queen, queen-jack suited. Those are all hands that are not particularly strong on that board. Even over pairs, depending on how deep you are not necessarily that excited about a 6-7-8 flop. So that's the kind of flop that you might not see a continuation bet as often from the preflop raiser. It's not a board where the preflop raiser has as strong of a range advantage as he might on a board like ace deuce deuce. And it's the kind of situation where you might consider donking with a variety of different types of hands. You might donk with some draws, you might donk with some made hands that are going to fold to a raise, you might donk with some made hands that are not going to fold to a raise, whether that's a set or whether it's the nuts. That's the kind of situation where I think donk betting makes sense. In terms of how to deal with a donk bet from someone else, I mean, you have to... you have to figure out whether they're doing it in an intelligent way or not. Some people like only dunk bet weak hands, and so you can, I mean, exploitively, you can do things like float them or bluff raise them. We'll talk a little bit about an example of that or several examples of that. Other times people dunk with more balanced ranges, and that's obviously harder to play against, but you, again, you want to respond to it in a kind of balanced way. You don't want to fold too often to it. You do want to have a value raising and a bluff raising range. You do want to have a floating range and a value calling range and all these different kinds of things. So let's try to get into some examples. The first couple of these are going to come from the Six Max event, which was, well, this is the kind of case where I think you'd expect to see more dunk betting in a shorthanded event. When you're dealing with an under-the-gun raiser, so if a player raises under the gun and the big blind calls, there's a really strong range advantage at work there. Like, the under-the-gun raiser tends to have a really strong range you need to raise under the gun at a nine-handed table. When you're talking about someone who's raising from the cutoff or the button and called by the blind, the range advantage is not as pronounced. The preflop raiser's range for opening from the cutoff or the button is not that much stronger than the player's, you know, the range of the player who calls out of the big blind. And therefore, we probably should see less continuation betting in these instances, at least among good players. So there's just more incentive for the player in the blinds to bet into the preflop raiser when the preflop raiser is someone who opened from late position. So I think it's not surprising that a lot of these examples are coming from the Six Max. Anyway, the first of these, I don't remember what the blind level was, but I know that I was in the cutoff with Ace of Spades and Ten of Clubs, and I opened for 2.5 times the big blind. I was called by a good player in the small blind, and the big blind folded. And the flop comes out Jack-9-7 with two spades, and I'm holding Ace-10 with the Ace of Spades. So I've got a gut shot. You know, my Ace and my 10 could be good. I could even have the best hand with Ace-High, and I also have a backdoor nut flush draw. The villain who called me out of the small blind bets half the pot on this flop. And this, you know, I said he's a good player, so my first assumption is going to be that he's probably not donk betting here in an extremely exploitive way. So he might be donking here with sets. I do think this is a pretty good board for donk betting, and it's a board where you could flop a lot of strong hands that don't want to give the preflop raiser a chance to check behind. You can imagine if you flop something like bottom set or top two pair on this board, you really don't want to see a check because the turn could easily be an 8 or a 10 or a spade, or even like a queen, cards that your hand that was really strong on the flop is not so strong when that turn card comes out. So there's a lot of reasons why if you flop a strong hand, you might want to bet the flop immediately. I think this player could also be betting here with a hand like, you know, king, queen of spades, or queen, ten of spades, where he's got some kind of big draw. You know, gut shot and a flush draw and over cards, or open-ended straight draw and flush draw. So he could be betting looking to 3-bet with a strong made hand. He could be betting looking to 3-bet with a strong draw. He could just be betting, planning on folding with a kind of weak hand like 7-6 or 8-7 or pocket eights. Or he could just be, you know, he could be bluffing with a hand like king-queen offsuit where he's got overcards and a gut shot, but he's going to fold to a raise. So I think there's a variety, or he could have, you know, made hand like ace-jack or something. I think that, you know, I think he's going to be somewhat balanced here, and I think he has incentive to bet with a lot of different sorts of hands. Now, my range is, you know, I have a lot of those same hands in my range. So I could have 10-8 suited for a flop straight. I could have queen-10 for an open-ended straight draw, king-queen for overcards and a gut shot. I have plenty of flush draws in my range. I have all the sets in my range, top two pair, bottom two pair. You know, I could have a lot of strong hands here also. I do want to be somewhat balanced in terms of how I play those, but I'm generally going to raise the flop with my strong hands and my strong draws more often than I call with them. And I think that my ace-10 is a very good bluff-raising candidate for a couple of reasons. One is that it is blocking a lot of villains' 3-betting range. So it's blocking the nuts, right? I block 8-10. I block queen-10. The ace of spades blocks the nut flush draw, which is another kind of hand that villain might bet 3-bet. So when I'm raising, planning on folding to a 3-bet, blocking my opponent's bet 3-betting hands, even if they're bluffs, you know, I'm going to fold to them, so I still want to block them. Blocking the hands that he's likely to 3-bet with on the flop is good. If my opponent bets and just calls a raise, which is something he might do with a hand like 9-7 or 10-9 or jack-10, then I want a hand that's live against his bet calling range. And so the fact that I can barrel spades, that I can turn a gut shot, that, you know, hitting an ace or a 10 could potentially give me the best hand, All those are reasons why, you know, if I raise here, I'm going to have to fold to a 3-bet, but if I just get called, I want a hand that has some playability. I don't want to bluff raise with a hand like pocket 3s here, because pocket 3s is going to play so badly when it's called, and it doesn't block any of his 3-betting range. So I think this is a good hand to make a bluff raise. I think it's not quite strong enough to call a bet, because it's going to be hard for me. You know, like, Willem can make a big bet on the spade turn. I'm not going to feel great about calling again or bluff raising at that point. If I hit an 8, sometimes he's going to have the same straight that I do. It's going to be hard to have implied odds. If I hit the gut shot, plus, I mean, it's only a gut shot. Hitting a 10, it's going to be hard to get that to show down, because the board's going to be jack 10, 9, 7. So even though I have ace 10, you know, that's going to be tricky. I don't think a lot of good stuff happens when I call. So I think taking a hand that you know, has okay equity if a raise is called, blocks some hands that are going to 3-bet. I think this is a very good candidate for bluff raising. So he bet half the pot. I went 3.5x his raise, you know, whatever that would be, and he folded to the raise. There was another hand a little later at the 100-200 level where I made a donk bet myself. So the button opened to 450, the small blind called, and I called with king 10 of spades in the big blind. This is a hand you could consider 3-betting with as well, and the deeper we are, the more I like 3-betting with suited broadways. We only started this tournament at 7,500 chips, so we probably weren't that deep at the 100-200 level. Anyway, the flop came queen 9-8 with one spade. So I'm holding king 10 of spades. I've got gut shot, backdoor spade draw, and, you know, king of the 10 might be live. This struck me as a pretty good donk betting spot. I do think, especially because there's two people, like both of the blinds called, the preflop raiser is not that likely to c-bet the flop with air. So I think, you know, I don't think my hand is really good enough to check call, and I don't know how profitable check raising is going to be, because I don't know that my opponent's going to have a really wide bet folding range. So if I check here, I think it has to be with the intention of folding to a bet. But I do think it's the sort of board where I want to have a donk betting range. If I've flopped something like a set or two pair or a big draw, I don't necessarily want to give the preflop raiser a chance to check behind and realize equity with a hand like ace-king or 8-7 or just those kinds of, like, hands that have... I don't really want a free card to come off here with a lot of my range. I think this is a hand where I want to have a situation where I want to have a donking range. I think that I'm going to need some bluffs to balance some of the stronger hands I want to donk on this board. And I think my hand, which is one that is similar to the previous instance, it's like it has a lot of equity when called. I don't think it has so much equity against people's raising ranges, so I don't feel too bad about bet folding it. It's going to have some good barreling opportunities when called. If I turn a spade, I can barrel that. If I turn an ace, it'll, you know, I'll have, like I said, the same gut shot, actually, if I turn an ace, so that's maybe not so helpful. But if what ended up happening here, so I bet 900 into, I guess there was 1350 at this point. I bet 900, the preflop raiser folded, and the small blind called. And this, I think, is like a great situation for me. Where now I've got the preflop raiser out, so I don't really have to worry about... So I get to play the next straight in position. And I think the small blind pretty well caps his range by just check calling here. I think he's probably check raising at least most of the time when he flops the nuts. He's probably check raising his sets and his two pairs. So I think when he check calls here, he's going to be doing a lot of check folding on the next straight unless the next card improves his hand. In this case, the turn was an offsuit 5, which is great. So it's queen 9-8. With, you know, one spade, two diamonds, and then the river is an offsuit 5. So this is not improving much of his range at all. Maybe he's playing 7-6 this way, but I think that's kind of a weak hand to check call on this board, because, I mean, hitting a 10 is not so great for you, and you have 7-6 and the board is queen 9-8. So I don't think he's real likely to have 7-6. I definitely don't think he's going to have, like, pocket 5s or queen 5 or something. So the 5 is about as blank as it can be. He checked. I bet 1,800. I about 4,500 behind. So I think if he calls again here, I can jam a lot of rivers. But he folded. And this is an example of the kind of situation you can set up by making that flop dunk bet where I accomplished. Even though I didn't take the pot down on the flop, I got the preflop raiser out from behind me, so I improved my position, and I got the small blind to cap his range, which enabled me to barrel again on the turn. Even though the turn didn't improve my hand, I thought I had a good barreling opportunity anyway, just based on the way the small blind responded to my flop bet. There was another one much later in the tournament, on day 2, where I actually dunked with a very strong hand. And this was kind of a rare instance, and this it's not this isn't really like those other two situations are situations that I've thought about before in the context of donking, but this particular one, it just kind of came to me in the moment, but I really like this line. I made a note of it to share. And these are all hands that I've shared on the blog already. I will talk about one that wasn't on the blog, but apologies to those of you who have seen these already. But I am talking about them in more detail here. So I opened under the gun with pocket fours. I'm afraid I don't remember the blind level, but I opened under the gun with fours. The player on the button, who is a pretty good player, made a small three bet, and I called. And I called just because it was only a small three bet, so I think that between the implied odds and the immediate odds that I was getting, I was probably getting something like 3.5 to 1 to call the three bet, and then there's some money behind as well. I mean, I think set mining is overrated against good players, but I think when you're getting a really good price on the original call, it's worth doing. So I called his three bet, and the flop came down King-9-4 rainbow. My opponent has about 20K to start the hand, and there was 6,700 in the pot when we saw the flop. King-9-4 rainbow is not necessarily a board that I would say is as good for dunking as the other ones, because you know those other two boards we've talked about, the Jack-9-7 with two spades, Queen-9-8 with two diamonds, those are both boards that have a lot of draws on them and where there's not a clear range advantage for the preflop raiser. This is a board that I think is pretty clearly better for the player who raised preflop than it is for me. He's going to have a lot more combinations of aces and ace-king and pocket kings than I am. So this is a board that I think pretty strongly favors his range. However, the fact that it pretty strongly favors his range does actually give him a lot of incentive to play back at a donk bet. So this is maybe getting a little exploitive, but I think you know if you have people who are donking into you in an unbalanced way, I'm going to talk about another example of that in a little bit. If you have players who are donking into you in an unbalanced way, you do want to try to play back at them on boards that pretty strongly favor you. And this is one where I think if someone, I mean, obviously no one is folding a king or better to a bet on this board. And I think that even hands like Queen Jack and Jack 10, maybe even Ace Queen and Ace Jack are going to be pretty tempted to float a donk bet. But if I check here, I think a lot of those hands are checking behind. So with the stack sizes being what they are, where I can pretty comfortably check shove, right? There's 6,700 in the pot, 20K in the effective stacks. It's actually really well set up for me to check shove here. So I think if my opponent has a hand like Queen Jack or Jack 10 or Ace Queen or Ace Jack, he might well want to check this flop rather than bet it. This is a tournament specific situation. This is specific to us having relatively shallow stacks here where there's room to just check shove the flop, and you're not going to see that in a three bet pot in a lot of cash games, but in a tournament it can happen. And so I thought for that reason he wasn't real likely to see bet here, even though he did have a range advantage, but he might try to give himself more room to play on future streets rather than risk getting check raised off of a hand that could have a lot of equity. So I didn't want to give him a chance to do that with my set. I think it does get a little harder for me to get value on a lot of turn cards. You know, Queen, 10, Jack all make it somewhat harder for me to get, even an ace makes it a little harder for me to get value out of my hand, I think. Because it's going to look really strong if I'm putting money into the pot on those cards. So I wanted to bet now on a spot where I could get floated by a lot of strong hands, maybe get bluff raised, etc. I bet 4,500 into 6,700, and my opponent called me. The turn was a 10, which is, you know, this is part of the reason why I wanted to get money in early, because I don't want the board to start running out in a way that's more favorable for my opponent. But now that it's happened, we've got about a pot size bet left in the effective stack. So there's 15-7 in the pot, 15K in his stack. So I check to him. I want to give him a chance. You know, I think if he does have a hand like, if he just has a one pair hand, ace, king, king, queen, pocket aces, I don't think he's going to check back at this point. The pot is so large, I think he's probably going to perceive my check as weak, and he's going to want to bet to protect his hand and to take down this large pot. So I'm not really worried about him checking back a pair. I mean, obviously, there's some chance he improved it to a straight, but you know, what are you going to do? I think that if he did float me with ace, queen, or ace, jack, he very well may try to bluff here. And he also might try to... I don't know whether he would bet a hand like jack 10, but I think if it goes check, check here, I mean, it sucks if the river is either an ace or a queen that puts a four straight on the board. But for the most part, or no, I guess an ace wouldn't put a four straight on the board. So really, the only like really bad river for me is a queen, which puts a four straight on the, a queen or a jack will put a four straight on the board. But other than that, I mean, I think I can, if it goes check, check here, I can still jam the river. So I'm not really missing out on that much by checking the turn in terms of getting value. I can still get stacks in on the river. I don't have to worry about building a pot across three streets. I checked, he shoved for 15K. Obviously, I called him and he had king queen. So in this case, when he flops that strongly with king queen, I don't think my line really matters much on this board, but I thought it was an interesting spot for dunk betting in terms of, you know, potentially getting value from other hands. You know, the other ones I didn't mention are like queens, jacks, and tens, but those are other hands that also might be tempted to check behind on this flop, but are definitely not going to fold to a dunk bet. So I kind of like dunking. I thought that was an interesting hand. The last one that I want to talk about comes actually from a 5-10 cash game. And this one is kind of exploitively responding to someone who is donking in a not good situation. And this is what I think a lot of people are really asking about when they're asking about dealing with donk bets, is like, how can I take advantage of people who I think are not donk betting in a very balanced way? I opened with king jack of diamonds in early position. Maybe I was like under the gun one or something like that. I opened to $30. It's a 5-10 game. Playing pretty deep. I opened to $30. I'm called by two players who are both in early position, and I'm also called by the big blind. We end up going to the flop with the $120 in the pot. $5 is taken out as rake. $120 in the pot, and the flop is 10-3-2 with one diamond and two spades. The first thing to recognize is this is a board, you know, I've raised in early position, and this is a board that does not change preflop equities very much. A couple of hands that were not very strong preflop have improved, so specifically pocket twos and pocket threes have turned into sets. Pocket tens is already a pretty strong hand preflop, and I don't know that these people are three betting if they have tens, but I mean, I'm also raising with tens, so it's not like anyone... I mean, I can flop a set as easily as anyone else can on this board, but I'm far more likely to have aces and kings and queens and jacks than anyone else is. And even when I don't have aces and kings and queens and jacks, the hands, you know, a hand like ace king still has pretty good equity on this board when my opponent doesn't have aces or kings. So, you know, even if I get action on this board, if I have ace king and I get action from pocket nines, that's not the end of the world. I mean, I still have a decent chance of drawing out on that hand. I have some chance of bluffing a player off of that hand by trying to represent, you know, a bigger hand. So this is just this is a very good board for the preflop raiser, and not really a good board for, especially when the preflop raiser is in early position. This board just kind of belongs to me, and that's how I think of it. When I see a flop like this, I say, okay, I raise from early position. I should be capturing a lot of the pot on a flop like this one, even in a four-way pot. My specific hand is a pretty decent one for that purpose, even though I didn't... So you might say, well, this isn't a very good flop, right? You didn't flop a pair, you didn't flop a draw. I did flop two overcards and several backdoor draws. I have backdoor diamonds, I have a backdoor straight draw. So this is a hand that I'm going to bet on this flop, even into three people, because it's a hand that... its equity holds up pretty well, even if it's called. So even if I do bet here and I get called, I'm going to have a lot of good barreling opportunities. I can turn a king or a jack. It's just, it's a good spot to bet. And as I said, this is a board that, because it's a board that's so good for me as an early position raiser, I think I get to do a fair amount of bluffing here, even with a hand as seemingly weak as king jack. What ended up happening instead, though, is the big blind bet out $40 into this pot of 120. Even ignoring the fact that this might be a sizing tell in terms of how strong his hand is, I think what's happening very often here is that this is some kind of probe slash protection bet. You're very, this player has a pocket pair. Maybe he paired the 10. More likely, I think he has like pocket sixes or somewhere in that neighborhood. And he kind of wants to see if he's good or just take the pot down immediately. You know, a lot of people make, I think, too big of a deal of the concept of initiative, where they say, oh, well, you know, it's so good to play with the initiative, and if you have the initiative, then you can steal pots on later streets. I don't think that's quite right. I think, you know, range advantage matters, and often, as I explained, the player who raised pre-flop, who has the initiative, also has a stronger range, but I mean, that's only a function of what his range is. So if you're raising too much pre-flop, initiative isn't really worth anything to you because you still have a really weak range pre-flop. And here, I mean, in some sense, this player is like trying to take initiative away from me by betting the flop, but he just doesn't have that strong of a range on this board. I mean, I don't think he's playing 10-3 or 10-2, probably not even 3-2. So it's not like he can represent nut hands that I can't. There's no reason why he gets to, I mean, he can't just take the initiative by betting. He can't just like suddenly have a stronger range by betting this flop. Even though he's trying to take the initiative, he's not really capturing the benefits that people usually think of as being associated with initiative by betting here. So the bottom line is, like, this is a flop that I was going to bet if check to, and so I'm not folding to a bet of 1/3 of the pot. Now, the biggest downside here is that my relative position has gotten a little bit worse. Like, I'm going to have to call this $40 without knowing what these two players behind me are going to do. But, I mean, obviously, if I had an overpair here, I'm not folding. And I don't know that I would raise the flop either, especially not if it was a big overpair like aces. That's really not, it doesn't have any protection concerns. Or not many protection concerns. So, I'm going to be calling this flop with a lot of pocket pairs of my own. If I pair the 10, I'm certainly going to call. And I need to be calling with weak hands as well, so that I have hands that I can bluff with on lighter streets. At some point, I very well may want to raise with pocket aces, or at least I want to give my opponent an incentive to keep bluffing when I have pocket aces. So I need to call with some hands that are not pocket aces as well, with some somewhat weaker hands that have the potential to turn into strong hands on certain runouts. And that's exactly what King Jack of Diamonds is on a 10-3 deuce with one diamond board. It's a hand that is not very strong, but has the potential to become strong on certain runouts. So I call the $30. I kind of want to see what happens behind me. If someone makes a big raise, I'll just end up folding. But hopefully I can call here and get out the people behind me and just be heads up with this player who I think is pretty weak to begin with. So I call the $30. I call the $40, rather, and both of the people behind me call as well. And that's not too surprising. I think they have a lot of pocket pairs in their range. Also, I think they might even be tempted to call with the same kind of hand that I have, someone with even queen-jack without a draw, or king-queen with one spade. The same sort of hand that I have might be tempted to call here, getting such a great price. So I don't make too much of the fact that I would have preferred that they fold, but I don't think the fact that they're calling here represents great strength on their part either. The turn brings an offsuit 9, so the board now is 10-9-3-2 with one diamond, which is my suit, and two spades. So I now, the 9 helps me out a little bit, gives me a gut shot. It makes it less likely that somebody else has pocket nines, which isn't necessarily a good thing for me. And if they do have nines, then obviously they've improved to another set. Someone with 10-9 has improved their hand a little bit. But this is a decent turn card for me. It's not as good as a queen or a jack or a king or a diamond, but it's a decent, it's maybe about an average turn card. It's certainly not one of the worst turn cards that I could see. The big blind now bets 60 into a pot of like 280. So, his bet has gotten even smaller relative to the pot. And I think at this point, it's like extremely unlikely that this player has a set. I think he would use larger sizing at this point. When he's been called by three people on the flop, and there's a lot of money behind. I mean, we're probably at least $2,000, if not $3,000 or $4,000 deep. So there's plenty of money behind. He should be looking to try to build a larger pot. I just think if he has a set or he has two pairs, he's going to use bigger sizing at this point. So he just bet 60. I'm definitely not folding. 60 into 280. I've got overcards, a gut shot, and potentially I think I have the opportunity to bluff the river as well. I mean, I'm still in a position where I can represent overpairs to the board, and so I want to have... And if my opponent checks the river, I'm going to want to bet for value if I have jacks or better. So, and then obviously if I have a set, although I might raise that on the turn. But I'm going to want to have a pretty healthy value betting range on the river, which means I need to get to the river with some hands that need to fluff as well. And this, I think, is a pretty good calling candidate. I could raise now and try to drive out the people behind me. But I also kind of, I do think there's a chance that someone behind me was slow playing a set. I mean, this is a decent flop for slow playing. So if I had a pocket pair, I don't know that I would want to raise now if I had aces. I think if I had aces, I would probably just call again now and look to either raise the river for value or value bet the river if check two, and potentially even fold if somebody behind me makes a big raise at this point. So I just call with the king jack. One of the players behind me calls and the other one folds. So we're going now to the river with like $460 in the pot, somewhere in that neighborhood. And the river is an offsuit 6. It's not the very best river card by any means. So 5-4 has gotten there. Pocket 6s has gotten there. Other than that, there's still a lot of hands that are not too strong at this point. So there's still pocket 4s, pocket 5s, pocket 7s, pocket 8s, jack 10, queen 10, 10-8, all these kind of hands that they're not going to be happy facing a big bet on the river, right? So what ends up happening, the big blind now checks. I think at this point, he 100% cannot beat an overpair. I think he's betting all the time that he can beat an overpair. And I think that the lack of a raise on the turn means that the player behind me also probably can't beat an overpair unless that six improved him. Some chance he has pocket sixes or 5-4 or I guess 8-7. I don't know that he would have called the flop with that, but if he did, he rivered a straight with 8-7. But I still think, you know, this is definitely a spot where I would want to make a value bet and probably a pretty big value bet with any overpair that I had. And so I'm going to follow through with my plan of bluffing now that I have... now that I have just king high, obviously it's a hand I'd like to bluff with. And I think that I get to do that because I could very easily play an overpair this way as well. So I bet 300 into the pot of 480 on the river, and both my opponents folded. That, that I think is a good example. And this is a somewhat more creative way. I mean, you definitely can do it by just raising the flop. Or raising the turn, but I think this is actually more consistent, at least in a deep stacked cash game situation, with how I would play an overpair. But the bottom line is, when somebody, you know, donks into you in a situation where you don't think they're balanced, and you think their hand range tends to be very weak, your inclination, you know, definitely should be to look for opportunities to take the pot away from them. And the reason you get to do that is because your hand range is so much stronger than theirs. So when you're thinking about how am I going to take the pot away from this, you know, weak donk better, you need to think about how would I play if I actually had a strong hand on this board. If I had flopped an overpair, or I flopped a top pair, or something like that, how would I play that hand? Would I raise the flop, or would I call the flop and bluff later? And you should do, you know, whatever that thing is with your weak hand. A lot of times people they're afraid to call bets with weak hands, even though that's how they would play strong hands. They say, well, if I just call, won't I look weak and my opponent will keep betting? Not necessarily. I mean, if calling is how you would play a strong hand, it's not so easy for your opponent to just keep on betting when you could easily have all these strong hands like overpairs and top pair and maybe even sets in your range. And I think that was the situation here. You know, my opponent was betting the flop, hoping that everyone was going to fold. Then they didn't do it, and he was kind of betting the flop for information. And at some point, he, you know, after two bets were called, he decided, and this is the problem with betting for information, he decided he had gotten the information that his hand was no good, and he checked, intending on, you know, at least giving up to a large bet. He did think a little bit before he folded, so I imagine if I had bet, you know, like $90 or $100, he would have called. But yeah, I mean, he's going to fold to a big bet, and that is an example of how you can take advantage of a player with a weak dunking range. As I said, I am back in San Francisco now. It was just, but after having already played the Scoop for 2.5 weeks and then 2.5 weeks in Las Vegas, I needed a break. I've never tried to do an entire summer. This is only the second time I've even, you know, played a decent number of prelims in the WSOP before. It's just a long time to spend in Vegas in the middle of the summer, so I'm taking about 2 weeks off. I will be back out for the main event. We hope to see you at the NickCast meetup, which will be on July 6th at the Gold Coast Bowling Alley between 10 a.m. and noon. And even if you come by afternoon, there's a decent chance we will still be there. We will be back with a proper episode next week. Nick will be here. We will have a guest, unless that falls through, but hopefully it won't. And thanks for your patience during the World Series of Poker. I hope you have found this episode, if not among our very best, at least better than nothing.